So far, we've been looking at more aesthetic things, artistic things. It gets a bit more technical now. Patents. What are patents for? Well, they're basically related to industrial inventions. They're not directed to artistic things. They've got to be something that's capable of industrial application, something that can be used in industry. And industry here can have quite a broad definition. It could cover agriculture, whatever. But it's got to be useful. And one of the most important things is that it's got to be novel. It's got to be new. And the derivation of this is probably historical. Way back 300 or 400 years ago, the crown, the king in Britain, rewarded people who introduced new methods of manufacture. And it didn't matter where they got them from. If they stole them from somebody in Italy, that was fine. But it was an encouragement to industry to say, if you bring in some new efficient manufacturing technique, I think one of them was an ability to make stained glass windows, for example. If you do that, we will reward you. And we will reward you by giving you a monopoly. And a monopoly means that only you can use this for a particular period of time. That is the origin of this. But it has to be new. You don't get rewarded if it's not new. Secondly, it has to be inventive. Now, this might sound very simple. Inventive, everybody knows what an invention is. But if you look back in the through the law cases, you'll find going back 100 years, people have argued again and again what we mean by that. Another way of saying it is the invention must not be obvious. And the principle behind this is that you should not be able to get patent protection for something that's not new, nor should you get patent protection for something that, although it's new, is something that ordinary people would want to do, would think of doing. So it's not just what has been done, it's what obviously would be the next step. And as I say, it's got to be have industrial application. It doesn't apply to certain things are specifically excluded, and we'll come on to those in a second. How do you get a patent? Well, you don't get a patent from just sitting around hoping for it to arrive through the letterbox. You'll have to file an application to a patent office, and there are different routes of doing this. If you want to get pretty broad territorial protection, you can make a filing at the European Patent Office. That will give you protection throughout Europe. You can file a national patent, and you also get you get a 12-month period to make applications elsewhere in the world, and those applications can be backdated by a year. So some choice. You don't just write and say, can I have a patent? Part of the deal is you have to explain how the invention works. So you have to produce a specification which sets out in detail how to carry out the invention. And the point of this is that it's a deal. The Crown says you're going to get, the state says you can have protection for a period of 20 years. But at the end of that 20-year period, other people have to be able to carry out the invention. And the way we enable that to happen is for you to tell people how to do it. And that's what the specification should do. If you don't tell people how to do it, you may have problems. So, although you've told people how to do it, they can't do it for the first 20 years, and after that, but after that, it's open, it becomes part of the public domain. The other thing, which is very important, at the end of the patent specification, are things called claims. And these are very short paragraphs, or maybe not always that short, and they have to say what it is that is covered by the patent. What is it that you can't do? Basically, I mean, if we had a patent going back some years for a ballpoint pen, it would probably say a writing implement containing ink with an end which has a small ball in it which enables the ink to be transferred to the paper or something like that. Now, that is not the patent, but that's the sort of thing you expect to be in a claim. You expect it to say, what is it that can't be done? Now, as I say, some things can't be patented at all. Computer programs can't be patented. People have tried very hard to patent computer programs with varying success. The usual way people do it is they pretend it's something else which is enabled by a computer program. But if you have a simple program, you can't say, I patent Word, you know, Microsoft Word. Microsoft couldn't patent that in Europe anyway. You're not allowed to patent business methods. I think recently we heard a lot of discussion in the press about Tesco having a system whereby you put products at the end of the aisles of the supermarket, in doing that, you could get more sales for that product. And they obviously did a deal where people got allowed to put their products, or their products were put at the end of the aisle, as long as they paid for it. So that is a way maybe of generating business. It's a business method, but you couldn't get a patent for that. You can't get a patent for a mathematical method. And some years ago, a gentleman devised a very, very good technique for calculating square roots of figures. It was clever, very clever. But basically, the court said, of course he complained the patent office wouldn't give him a patent, the court said, no, this is really a mathematical method. It's a way of carrying out a calculation, and you can't have a patent for that. I think it's a bit harsh. Of course, it was useful, but not allowed. You can't have patents for presentations of information and literary and artistic works, etc. That's perhaps rather obvious. What about this one? Now, most of you have seen this. Most of you have used it. It's the Amazon one-click process at the end of their website if you've decided you want to buy something. This has been very successful. A lot of people, I'm sure, use Amazon because, having registered with Amazon, put their credit card details in, they know they can buy something in a matter of minutes rather than plodding their way through endless pages requesting them to put in data. This stops people having to do that. Very clever. Is it patentable? No, it's not. Because although it was very clever, they said it was argued that it wasn't. The only novelty of this was that there was some step in the background to this technique which was different from that used in previous types of process. So it was new and may have been clever, but it was said that what they had done was actually improved a business method. There was no, and you were not allowed to rely upon improvements of business methods in order to get a patent. So this is a very practical example, very useful, which has basically not been entitled to have patent protection in Europe, at least. Still arguments going on in America, etc., where the law is different. But success doesn't necessarily mean patentability. Another thing to bear in mind is that you may think once you've got your patent through the patent office, that's the end of it. You've won. You can stop everybody. It's not as simple as that. And in fact, being granted a patent by the patent office is really a provisional step. It doesn't mean you have a valid patent. It means the patent office has had a good look at it, done its best, and attempted to decide whether it's novel, whether it's inventive. It had a look, it's carried out a search for prior publications, it's looked at them, it says on the basis of what it's seen, you're entitled to a patent. Now, this decision is based upon what they know. I'm going to show you a little tale. This is a very successful patent related, or product, I should say, related to wind surfers. Obviously, you couldn't get a patent for a sail on a fixture of boat or whatever, but this particular invention had some specific particular features. It was obviously a windsurfer, which allowed you it had a universal joint here, which allowed the sail to be moved around, and they could swivel the whole thing round when they wanted to change direction. It also had these booms, these rods down the side, which hold the sail out, which were in the shape of an arc. They're called arcuates, that's what they call them in the patent. And that allowed the sail to bend outwards. Now, if you're windsurfing, I suppose a lot of you have done it, you would stand on the board here and your hands would be on the boom and you'd lean out here. So this was a very clever idea. But there's a bit of history. Back in the 1950s, late 1950s, a chap called Newman Darby used to go on his holidays to a lake in the United States, he used to take his surfboard with him. A lot of people would paddle around on surfboards. He started paddling around, you know, with a paddle, and then he found that if he stood up on the surfboard and he held the paddle out, and as we can see, it's quite a broad paddle, and he has the wind behind him, he moved along. And then he could change direction, no doubt, by moving around and putting the paddle in a different place. So I thought, this is very clever. And he thought, well, I could make this even better. So what he did was he had the surfboard, as before. He had the universal joint. He had a sail, and what you'll see is happening here, the wind's behind here, just as it was as his paddle, if you remember, the wind's here. So the wind's coming up from behind, there's a square sail here, and you stand in front of it and you rotate it, not in a rather cumbersome way, you steer it. Now, these square sails, very similar to very old sailing boats. Now, the problem was that Mr. Darby didn't have much money and he didn't have much time. So although he started a business in selling these surfboards, he didn't actually make a tremendous amount of money out of it. Now, there was another story, a parallel story, and the pictures aren't very good, but this was about a boy, about 12 years old, 1958, he built what appeared to be a windsurfer. I'm not sure this is contemporaneous. And he made it from curtain rods, the rods that you hang curtains on. That was the boom, if you remember. In a triangular sail, and he sailed across a bit of the south coast of England. This wasn't commercial. He was just playing around. He just built it himself. He didn't publish anything, nothing written about it. Now, when these people, Schweitzer and Drake, who were the people who invented the windsurfer we started off with, they didn't know anything about Mr. Chilvers, they didn't know much about Mr. Darby. They knew nothing about it at all. Unfortunately, Mr. Chilvers it was very similar to this. And the important thing was that Chilvers had done what he'd done in 1958 or wherever, a long time before the patent was filed. The priority date is the date upon which the earliest patent for this was filed anywhere. So that's the date when you decide whether this is inventive. Well, Mr. Schweitzer and Drake didn't like competition very much. They sued a company called Tabor Marine, who was making windsurfers. Tabor Marine said, your patent's invalid. And they said, and the reasons are, that Mr. Chilvers was using something identical before you filed your patent application. Schweitzer and Drake said, no, it wasn't the same, because the boom, this bit here you hang off, was straight. It's just bits of straight wood here, and the patent requires it to be arcuate, to be in the shape of an arc. The court said, no, when you use Mr. Chilvers' sailboard, windsurfer, and you lean on it, the booms, these bits here, will become arcuate. You'll lean out and they'll bend. So when it is actually being used, it is identical to that. So you can't have a patent. They also said, in any event, it would be invalid because the use of, okay, the sail is different from that sail, the square sail, and it's, you know, pushing from behind. But they say it would be obvious to change one type of sail for another. So this is an unfortunate case in many ways, because you have people who quite innocently filed a patent, they made a good invention, but it wasn't valid. They didn't know that. Hardly anybody knew about Mr. Chilvers, a 12-year-old, 13-year-old boy. He didn't publish anything. Somebody just knew about it. And then he explained what had happened. So when we're deciding whether a patent's new and inventive, we don't just look at what is published in scientific documents. You can also look at what people have done, what they've used. And in this case, it was absolutely fatal. Bit sad. Well, so you have to be rather careful about how you draft your patent specification. In the case of Schweitzer and the windsurfer, they tried to limit it by particular technical features like the arcuate boom, etc., etc., to distinguish it from things that had gone before. Well, what we have here is, anyone know? A Dyson hand dryer. I'm sure many of you have used this. Now, if you're going to get a patent for your Mr. Dyson, and you want to get a... Sorry, beg your pardon. You want to get a patent for this hand dryer, you can't just have a patent which says, I claim a hand dryer, or I claim a device which produces hot air, which people can blow over their hands and dry them. They've been known for years. They're not new. You couldn't patent them. So what is it? What sort of patent could Mr. Dyson get? Well, why is this hand dryer, in Mr. Dyson's words anyway, better than what had gone before? Well, basically, the promotion for this hand dryer says you can dry your hands in 15 seconds on both sides. And you know, with conventional hand dryers, you go to Oxford Station, there'll be a nozzle and you put your hands under like this, and then you have to do the back. And it takes a long time. The thing about Dyson's hand dryer is you just put your hands in up and down, like this. 15 seconds later, they're dry. And what he basically had done is say, well, we're going to shape this so that it's like somebody's hand, so the back of the hand is facing this side, and the front there. So the distance between the machine and the hand is the same. All the way up here, it's going to follow the shape of the hand, and it's going to blow air from both sides, very strong air jet, move them up and down very quick. So basically, it was this idea of being able to dry both sides of the hand at the same time. Obviously, you couldn't get a patent for just a hand dryer. So you have to look at what the new features are. What is it that's new? What's made it different? What's made it an invention? Patents, not everybody gets a patent. Not everybody wants a patent. And some things you just can't patent at all. If you have an industrial process which is very efficient, it may be successful because It has, it's used, they've just optimized the temperature, the pressure, the speed at which certain machine goes, a lot of manufacturing data. It may be in volumes, but there's nothing patentable there. You can't point to an invention. You can still protect that, but it would have to be protected as know-how. And the law will protect know-how. It varies across Europe as to how that protection operates, but this is the UK position. If you can show it's confidential, the information is confidential, and if you told somebody else about it, like your employees or your researchers, and you told them in confidential circumstances, I mean, an obvious way to do it is to say this is confidential, then you can protect it as long as it doesn't enter the public domain, as long as it doesn't become public. Now, this doesn't have to be complicated. As I say, it could be masses and masses of technical data for a manufacturing process, but it can be simple. And this is not just technical information, it's also commercial information. I'll give you one example. There were a pop group called the Rock Bottom Girls, and they thought they had a great idea for a television series which would describe the adventures of this pop group as it toured around the country. So they approached Thames Television, as they then were, ITV, whatever, and their manager, Mr. Fraser, said, told ITV, he said, well, would you be interested in this idea we've got? And they said, yeah, it sounds interesting. He said, well, if you want to do a series like this, a condition is that you put the girls in it as part of the cast. You give them jobs. So they went away, and they did produce the series, but they didn't put the girls in the cast. They ignored it. Mr. Fraser and the girls sued Thames Television, and they said, you're in breach of confidence. There was a lot of argument, actually, in the case about copyright and the idea. Well, we know you can't have copyright in an idea, but eventually they got to this point, saying, well, it may not be any copyright in the idea, but the idea was confidential. And Thames Television had no right to use it except on the conditions that had been proposed to them. So it can be very simple. That was all the confidential information, but it's protected. So it can be very, very effective as a means of protecting information. And it's cheap, it doesn't cost you anything. I'll give you one important example. It means here we say it can last forever. The recipe for Coca-Cola. That has been kept confidential since 1886. And that's much longer than any patent. And they lock it away in a safe, in a vault somewhere. And apparently, very few people know what it is, except those that are using it to make product. But it's almost perpetual. So if you look after your secret information, your know-how, your confidential information, you can have protection forever. One of the problems with it is that it's easily lost. So if it leaks out and there's no breach of confidence, or you publicise it in some way, it wouldn't be very good for protecting Mr. Dyson's hand dryer, because as soon as Mr. Dyson had installed that hand dryer in a washroom somewhere, everybody would know or be able to find out how it was made. They could take it to bits. So that was in the public domain. So protection for that is a patent. No use for that. But information processes, things that are secret, you can get very long protection. So not to be forgotten. And people often forget about this in terms of intellectual property. Some people say it isn't intellectual property at all, but it performs the same function.